Hey everyone, this is our third time live streaming on Zoom from Blue Mountain Zendo here in Mission, BC, and I'm kind of in awe of this phenomenon. It's so great that you have all turned out for this, and the surprise benefit is people from quite some distance, you know, in our extended Sangha around the Northwest, and people who can't make it to the Zendo sometimes, even if they're in town. So who knows? Who knows what this will open up for us? You know, just as so much is contracting, maybe there's something else opening up. Michael and I, a couple days ago, went for a walk along Hayward Lake, which is nearby here, on a beautiful sunny day, and there were great numbers of people out for a weekday, and everyone was really friendly, greeting each other. You know, they were maintaining the appropriate so-called social distance. I like to call it, I got this idea from somewhere, to call it physical distance rather than social distance, because there's nothing that's saying we have to stop being social. So people were out and they were so friendly, all ages, families, dogs, and it was uplifting to be out in the fresh air and sunshine with others, more even than usually are there. So I hope that those of you who are well, which I hope is all of you, but those of you who are well, will go out in the sunshine and the fresh air and smile and greet people around you. So on to my talk. About a month ago, I gave a talk on a Wednesday, on a Monday night at Zen U, our Young Urban Zen group. And my talk was about self-care for bodhisattvas. And when I realized that that was a month ago, I kind of was set back thinking how much has changed in that month, how much has happened in that month, shifting daily in response to the COVID-19 crisis. So I thought I'd reprise that talk in light of all that's happened since. My thinking about self-care a month ago was prompted simply by an opinion piece I read in the Globe and Mail called Self-Care versus Life Hacking. It caught my eye because I didn't know what life hacking was. So my curiosity was piqued. The writer, who is named Kate Carraway, talks about how the self-help trend of earlier decades, which kind of flogged a dogged pursuit of self-improvement, how that trend has modulated in the past decade or so to what she calls the pursuit of wellness. And she describes it as a softer, gentler, more forgiving trend than the self-flagellating self-improvement or self-help days. The trouble with this softer, gentler approach to self-care is that it can easily be dismissed. Like, self-care is for wimps. You gotta push through. I'll bet some among us are prone to pushing through. So you could call that a kind of macho dismissal. But there's also another kind of dismissal of self-care, which is that self-sacrificing devotion to the cause or the work. There can be an almost competitive workplace ethos. Have you ever heard somebody say, oh, I worked so hard on this project, I ended up getting sick, or I'm so exhausted, but as you can see, I soldier on. You know, that kind of discourse. But all that has been called into question this past month. We're not supposed to drag ourselves into work sick and exhausted anymore. Carraway, who wrote this opinion piece, points out that it's easy to criticize the contemporary consumer product-based self-care trend because it's distanced from an awareness of global systemic issues and distanced from a sense of collective responsibility to address those issues. So it's easy to dismiss self-care as narcissistic and a shallow pursuit of ease, relaxation, and enjoyment of consumer products. But she cautions, I think astutely, that critique can be very easily conflated with a disparaging attitude, particularly towards young women, and what it's like to be a young woman in the world today. So she's speaking up for those young women, and particularly for those who are socially or politically marginalized. She insists that more accurately, self-care is about the body and the brain and managing the psychic ravages of stress, illness, pain, trauma, precarity, poverty, and abuse. And then she cites early feminists like the African-American lesbian writer and poet Audre Lorde, who meant a lot to many of us, I think, back in the maybe the 70s and 80s, she posited self-care as a radical act. Audre Lorde wrote, "Caring for myself is not self-indulgence, it is self-preservation, and that is an act of political warfare." So, what does our Buddhist practice have to say about all this? What would a bodhisattva's guide to self-care be? People ask me about this. People come to Dokusan. People who place a high value on being of service to others. People who work in a helping or healing profession. Making a difference in the world. People who are dealing with family situations where much of their energy goes to supporting and caring for others. So what does self-care mean in these circumstances? So I asked these questions a month ago, and now they have an even stronger sense of urgency and poignancy as we try and keep our footing in the shifting sands of COVID-19. What is it to take care of ourselves for and with everybody else? I've noticed that sometimes Buddhist teachings are presented in a way that can seem to perpetuate the self-other split, that make us feel guilty if we take time to ourselves, or that we conflate with the habits of guilt that we already have. When Michael and I first ordained, our teacher, Norman Fisher, gave us three texts that he felt were important for Zen priests to chant and to contemplate. One of them was the Eight Verses of Training the Mind by an early 12th century Tibetan teacher, Langri Tangpa Dorje Senge. The first verse goes like this: "With a determination to accomplish the highest welfare for all sentient beings, who surpass even a wish-granting jewel, I will learn to hold them supremely dear." A determination to accomplish the highest welfare of all sentient beings, holding them supremely dear. That's a big, daunting aspiration, isn't it? I think many of us feel that way when we first encounter the Bodhisattva vows. It's an expression of bodhicitta, the mind of awakening, that aspiration to awaken not just for oneself, but for all beings. And then the second verse goes, Whenever I associate with others, I will learn to think of myself as the lowest among all and respectfully hold others to be supreme from the very depth of my heart. So when I first read this, I had to go to Norman and ask. I said, you know, I already habitually put myself down and think that I am less than others in so many ways. And I know that's not wholesome. And I know it actually gets in the way of not being, of benefiting others, of fully offering my life. But it's a pretty strong conditioning. And Norman said something like, well, the verse overstates it to make the point, because the human tendency towards self-focus is so strong. But I wasn't entirely satisfied with that response. The Dalai Lama gives a commentary on these verses online. You can find it online. And he says, certainly, this verse is not saying that you should engage in thoughts that would lead to lower self-esteem, or that you should lose all sense of hope and feel dejected, thinking, I'm the lowest of all. I have no capacity, I cannot do anything, and I have no power. One of the reasons for using the word lower is to emphasize that normally when we give in to ordinary emotions of anger, hatred, strong attachment, and greed, we do so without any sense of restraint. Often, we are totally oblivious to the impact our behavior has on other sentient beings. But by deliberately cultivating the thought of regarding others as superior and worthy of your reverence, you provide yourself with a restraining factor. Then, when emotions arise, they will not be so powerful as to cause you to disregard the impact of your actions upon other sentient beings. It is on these grounds that recognition of others as superior to yourself is suggested. So that goes a little further, and it's helpful. We know how reactive and self-concerned we can all be when our sense of identity is threatened, when our buttons are pushed, when we feel judged or blamed. So the practice here is to take a step back and open up our view to include the other as a suffering, confused human being just like us, to bring awareness to our body-mind and refrain from reacting in a way that will only cause more pain to both. So if we can maybe just set aside the charged words of superior and lower, I think we can understand this verse at a deeper level. The next verse goes a step further. It says, in all actions... Oh, and by the way, 2 weeks from now, I'm going to talk more about this set of verses, and I will post a PDF so you can read along. But for now, here's the third verse. In all actions, I will learn to search into my mind, and as soon as an afflictive emotion arises, endangering myself and others, I will firmly face and avert it. As soon as an afflictive emotion arises, endangering myself and others, I will firmly face and avert it. So here, self and other are included equally. And our practice is to notice afflictive states that threaten to harm others or ourselves. I mean, both, really. This means we can't get away with those cruel or careless thoughts we have towards ourselves or to others, or those self-destructive habit patterns. We can't just say, oh, well, that's not hurting anyone else, when we're being cruel to ourselves. It does. It does hurt those who care about us, and it deprives others of the full expression of our being in this world, what we have to offer. I find it helpful to go back to the Buddha's words. There's a passage in the Pali Suttas that goes like this. Searching in all directions with your awareness, you find no one dearer than yourself. That might not be quite true. Usually sometimes we find others who we think are dearer than ourselves. But he says, in the same way, others are dearest to themselves. So you should not harm others if you love yourself. So this is the Buddhist version of the Golden Rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. There's a reason that when the practice of metta or loving kindness is taught, you start with yourself. Because if you don't have the capacity for kindness to yourself, if you're mean and judgmental towards yourself, you will limit your ability to extend kindness to others. And maybe in just subtle ways that you're not even aware of. So in metta practice, we use simple phrases. Many of you know this, I'm sure. Usually no more than three. Or if the words get in the way, you can use just a felt sense of warmth and kindness towards yourself. And then on the rhythm of the breath, extending that loving kindness first to yourself, then to a dear friend, a benefactor, a neutral person, and then eventually to a difficult person, and to all beings, if you do the classic practice. And you can do that sequence in a short period of time, or in a whole day, or a whole week. You can do a full week retreat, spending a whole day on each of those. Some typical phrases may be, may I be happy, may I be well in body and mind, may I be safe from harm, my heart be at ease, and then of course extending those to you, to others. And then if you shift into compassion practice, the phrases shift from wishing happiness and well-being to wishing freedom from fear, freedom from pain and suffering, more directly addressing suffering beings, one's own suffering, suffering of others. So you usually start with metta to soften and open the heart before moving on to karuna or compassion practice. And then the other two practices in the set that are called the Brahma Viharas, or noble abodes, are equanimity and joy. This coming weekend, Michael will be focusing on equanimity practice. We'll say more about that later. And joy and equanimity balance and support loving kindness and compassion. And together they form the core of a self-care practice that goes much deeper and wider than the approaches of the driven self-care agenda or the indulgent self-pampering with expensive products or upping your performance with life-hacking metrics. This is a very deep and wide self-care practice. With a little Googling, I learned that what self-hacking is. I didn't know that. It is apparently a concept that has tended to stress technological ways to increase performance, to do tasks more efficiently and productively, to improve your physical fitness or, your performance. And Carraway, who wrote the opinion piece, claims that this life hacking has typically been characterized as a sort of masculine pursuit, data-driven, popularized by Silicon Valley CEOs, stressing domination and control of the body. But neither the soft self-care or the life hacking trend goes to the roots of discontent, anxiety, the never good enough mentality that our society promotes. The comparing mind is always measuring the self against others. The Buddha taught that all comparisons are a version of self-clinging. Worse than, better than, just as good as, just as bad as, it's all self-clinging. A true self-care practice opens to the deep insight that my well-being is inextricable from the well-being of others. This is the self-care of a bodhisattva, and this is the self-care that is being summoned by an invisible virus that magnified looks like kind of a harmless cat toy. Have you seen pictures of the coronaviruses? They look just like little cat toys. Maybe you have some examples of how taking care of yourself is of benefit to others and how taking care of others is of benefit to you. Maybe you've had experiences where you weren't even aware of the difference. Just like reaching out a hand, like in the old Zen koan, reaching out a hand to adjust the pillow to support the head. So these days, because we're not reaching out our hands, we can reach out with a smile, an email, a phone call, an offer of a ride, a walk, a shared moment. I was recalling how I gave a Dharma talk. I wasn't sure when it was. I gave a Dharma talk called Zen Practice as Disaster Preparation. And so I looked it up in my files, and I realized it was some months after the Tohoku earthquake and tsunami and nuclear disaster in Japan, which I felt very deeply because we'd just been in Japan a few months prior to that. So I wanted to look back at this Dharma talk, curious to see what I had said 8 years ago. So if you'll forgive me for quoting myself, this is one passage that struck me. I said, we humans like to think magically about disaster prevention. We like to think that if we behave ourselves and are reasonably good people, if we live in good neighborhoods and send our kids to good schools, pay our bills, drive carefully, eat reasonably well, take our vitamins, disasters will not befall us. And yeah, sure, common sense and good behavior can certainly reduce our risks to an extent. And we're all doing our part these days to exercise common sense and due precautions. But there's nothing like a disaster to shake us out of our complacency and make us vividly aware of the fragility and resilience of life, and to remind us of what's most important in life, and to offer us unexpected gifts of beauty and intimacy right in the middle of the pain and the loss. I know this to be true from my rather limited experience of personal disaster, and I'm sure many of you do too. But I personally have never experienced a large-scale disaster. And it feels like we're kind of tipping on the edge, you know? Many, many people are feeling a lot of fear not just of the illness, but fear of financial crisis, losing jobs, yeah, and certainly in some parts of the world, great fear of the illness itself, much more than we are feeling. So at that time, 8 years ago, I read a book called A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster by Rebecca Solnit, who's a writer I greatly admire. Encourage you all to read. Her theme in the book is the way that we humans respond collectively to disasters, which she discovered in her research is much more altruistic, compassionate, courageous, and cooperative than on the whole than Hollywood or the popular press would have us believe. Although the popular press, I don't spend a lot of time with it, but we are hearing stories. We are hearing stories of cooperation, creativity, and courage. One of the stories she tells in the book is how the residents of Tassajara is the most remote of the three locations of San Francisco Zen Center, how they responded to a massive wildfire in July of 2008. And she quotes this passage. The center kept an online journal during the period of the fire. She quotes the journal. The writer said, what was most compelling during these hours, and which in reflection remains the most satisfying, is the constant vigilance and effort that the fire required. It was a demanding schedule of pure presence in which one utterly let go of a known outcome. There were undeniable moments of fear and anxiety, especially when we understood the reality that the fire was descending into Tassajara fast and from all sides, rather than creeping down one slope at a time, as had been suggested by several professionals. But there was little time to entertain fear, so fear quickly gave way to our effort to fully meet our belated guest and the tasks at hand. When I read this, I reread this, I thought about the doctors and the healthcare workers in places like Wuhan and Italy, northern Italy, the hot spots of the pandemic, and they must have felt just like this, fighting a wildfire, huh? Still feel. David Zimmerman, who at that time was the director of Tassajara and is now abbot at City Center, and who was one of the, what became known as the Tassajara Six, six people who went back after disobeying an evacuation order, went back and fought, really saved the building, the Zendo, the buildings of Tassajara. He wrote at the close of that online journal, a few days after that previous entry, he wrote, and finally, deep bows to the fire, whose undeniable Dharma teaching of impermanence has earned our awed respect and attention. Do you think we'll be able to bow to COVID-19 when all this settles? The abbot at the time, Steve Stuckey, who was also one of the Tassajara Six, said that for him the fire enforced the teaching of being prepared to meet whatever arises. So this is our disaster preparedness practice. Each time we sit down on our zafu, each time we attend a retreat or sesshin, each time we wake up in the morning, we never really know what's coming next, what unexpected arising will come from within or without. Rebecca Solnit comments, disaster could be called a crash course in Buddhist principles of compassion for all beings, of non-attachment, of abandoning the illusions of one's sense of separateness, of being fully present, of awareness of ephemerality and of fearlessness, or at least aplomb in the face of uncertainty. Now, Pema Chodron, the American Tibetan teacher, calls it being comfortable with uncertainty. We could also say that Buddhist practice is crafted to help us cultivate the very capacities and qualities, slowly and patiently, the very capacities and qualities that sometimes are summoned forth by extreme circumstances. Compassionate action, generosity, courage, and a sense of unity with others. In fact, the discovery and experience of these capacities and qualities in oneself and others can be felt as a gift, with a kind of vivid joy, right in the midst of terrible suffering and loss. When we show up fully and pay attention. So I'll stop there for now, and in a few minutes we'll have a chance to hear from you. But first let's chant the closing chant, Dharma Talk closing chant together, so you can unmute, if you will. May our intention equally extend to every being and place, with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it. So let's stand or sit and do three bows. Oh no, we're not. We're going to go right into service. So we'll just rearrange slightly, and we're going to go right into service.